everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If there's one thing we all know about the Middle Ages, it's that being an illegitimate child meant that you were cast out, scorned, reviled, and left to fend for yourself. Just look at poor Jon Snow, the saddest, most freezing cold bastard on Game of Thrones. But wait a second. This was a time before reliable birth control, which meant that there were a whole lot of illegitimate children running around. Were they all really banished to the Wall for good? For this week's episode, I've invited Dr. Sarah McDougall to talk to us about what it was like to be a bastard in medieval Europe, and more specifically, whether or not being illegitimate meant you couldn't be a part of one of the most important institutions of the time, the priesthood. Sarah McDougall is an associate professor of history at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice of the City University of New York, as well as being on the French and History faculty at CUNY's Graduate Center. She's the author of Royal Bastards, The Birth of Illegitimacy, 800 to 1230 from Oxford University Press, as well as Bigamy and Christian Identity in Late Medieval Champagne. Sarah's work on bastard priests has just come out in the latest issue of Speculum, a journal of medieval studies. Here's our conversation on bastards, priests, and whether or not a person could actually be both at the same time. So thanks, Sarah, for joining us and talking to us today about bastard priests. I'm really excited to learn more about this topic. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Danielle. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's awesome to have you. So you just wrote an article for Speculum on bastard priests, and it's talking about illegitimacy kind of in general, and then ordination. So I think there's this general idea that if you're illegitimate in medieval Europe, then that's pretty much it for you. There's nothing available for you to do in life. Is that true?
It is true that people think that it's true. It is absolutely true that people think that this is one of the sort of key features of the medieval family or of medieval social structure, that if you are illegitimate, there's something like a gigantic scarlet I or B for bastard, I guess is what I should say, on your chest, and that this is some kind of permanent disability, that everybody knows that you're illegitimate, that everybody cares that you're illegitimate, and that you can't do anything. And in particular, you couldn't, of course, be a king, and you couldn't be a priest, and that it would interfere with many, 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 many things that you might want to do in life. And I think that that's not true.
So what kind of opportunities would people have? If you're illegitimate, would it be the same as being a legitimate child, or would things be a bit different for you?
So a lot depends on when. Before basically the 13th century, it's hard to know who was and wasn't illegitimate and what counted as illegitimate or not, or what consequences it had. After the 13th century, in principle, if you were born outside of what was considered a legitimate marriage, which is a complicated thing itself, you were supposed to have different inheritance rights, so you didn't have the same automatic in principle, at least, rights to inheritance. And in principle, you could not have certain high status occupations. You might not be allowed to give testimony. There's all kinds of things that in principle you couldn't do that the law was by that time explicitly saying you couldn't do. And you do start to see litigation that makes it clear that in principle people might not be able to do these things. But as I'm sure you can hear from the way I'm putting this in practice, it's quite different and much more complicated.
It wasn't a scarlet letter.
No, not at all. I mean, identity was just so complicated. And even if you were somehow considered illegitimate, it was a mutable thing. There were actually legal mechanisms that could make you legitimate, even without your parents ever having been married or even having be possible to be married. So you could be the son of a nun, and you could end up being considered legitimate. Or you could have various other dispensations, or various other things could happen, and the legal processes wouldn't even necessarily come up. as something that you had to engage in order to be able to have that job that you wanted or marry that man that you wanted. It just didn't matter as much as people tend to think that it did.
And you say in the article that even though there might be some difficulty in inheritance, that a bastard child could still have the right to be taken care of by the parents.
Yeah. And this is something I'm actually working on right now. So my current research is on single mothers, basically, or on out-of-wedlock pregnancies and their consequences for women, for mothers. And there is in the canon law from the 12th century on an explicit statement that, and in the theology also, that all children have a natural law obligation. Natural law is just their way of saying this is something so intrinsic, so important to our society that it must be recognized. It ought to be allowed. So there is a natural law principle that all children have a right to nurture from their parents. And so all children, regardless of how illegitimate, how bad the parents were behaving when they conceived this child. So even if it's a monk and a nun, or even if it's, you know, a brother, sister, anything, the child has a right to life and the parents must somehow provide for this child. They don't have automatic rights to inheritance. They can't inherit in principle property that the parents get from their parents, but they have to be provided for somehow, that it is a Christian obligation that all children are provided for by their parents, and if the parents can't do it, that they somehow get somebody else to do it.
And this is complicated because according to Christian dogma at the time, you couldn't visit punishment on the children for the sins of the parents. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's because it's Christian dogma, it's complicated, right? And so on the one hand, they will say you are not supposed to punish children for the sins of the parents. And then sometimes there are moments where it is appropriate, or it's appropriate to do things that look like punishing children for parents' sins, but they're not doing it for that purpose, so it's okay. But generally, the focus is on people should be punished for their own sins, and children have an absolute right to not be punished for their parents' sins and to be allowed to live and to be provided for by their parents or by somebody else. Where the conflict really comes up is the effort to punish parents for their sins, indulging in somehow illicit sex, and then also the effort to make sure that people who are in those situations can't allow their children to be treated as if they were legitimate, not because they want to punish the children, but because they want to enforce these rules about what legitimate marriage provides for children as opposed to any other kind of union. So it's an effort to make marriage distinct and important, and the, you know, for marriage to have these benefits and only marriage. And then also it's an effort to make sure that a priest is not giving his children property that belongs to the church. And so there is this conflict between wanting to punish parents for sins, wanting property to stay in the hands of either legitimate families or the church, and this obligation to nurture, which, you know, in practice may well have been far less important, but seems to have had more of a role than people knew.
In this article that you did for Speculum, you were thinking about illegitimacy in terms of who could be a priest. And one of the rules was that if you were an illegitimate child, especially an illegitimate child of a priest or a nun, then you could not be a priest yourself. So there are lots of different rules about who could be a priest. So can you go over some of those with us?
Yeah. So there's a general sense that that being illegitimate might have been the most important thing for determining whether or not you could be a priest, especially being the son of a priest. especially because of that idea that priests should not be able to give church property to their sons, that a church property or a priesthood should not be a possession that can go from father to son to father to son. There's that idea is there eventually in medieval canon law, and certainly there's some effort to not let fathers let their children inherit their benefices, their, you know, the offices as priests. But there's a whole bunch of other rules too. So, I mean, the most important rule almost goes without saying, you had to be male. That took a little bit of time to get fully expressed, because the idea of what even counted as a priest as opposed to some kind of other religious person took a little while in early Christianity to develop. But certainly you had to be male, because only men, as I'm sure you've noticed, only men resemble God. And so only they can be priests, because priests have to resemble God. So you have to be male. That gets a little complicated in that you had to present as male. You didn't necessarily, there's some interesting questions about intersex that we can get into later if you want. But I'll go through all the rules, and then I'll let you tell me what you want to know more about. So you had to be male. You had to be a certain age. In principle, you had to have no disabilities. This relates to something I think you were talking about in a previous podcast.
Yep.
So you had to have no obvious missing limbs. You had to have, in particular, there was an idea that your face had to have a certain kind of symmetry. You couldn't have any eye defects. You couldn't be castrated, sort of. I mean, you couldn't be intentionally castrated, and that's another really complicated and fascinating and sort of entertaining aspect. In principle, you had to be a fully intact, perfect male. You had to look right. You also couldn't be too young or too old. And then you also, even more importantly, couldn't be married. You couldn't have been married in the past to someone who had been a widow or not a virgin or something. There's these old biblical ideas about the husband of one wife. Your marital history had to either be non-existent, or it had to be just to a single woman, you know, someone who was single before you married her, and then she had to be out of the way or willing to get out of the way, basically. You couldn't stay married to her. You had to have free status, so you couldn't be a slave. You had to be emancipated. So there's all of these considerations, and many of them were far more important than whether or not your parents had been married or whether or not your parents had been priests or nuns.
When I looked through this list in the article, there were a few things that I didn't realize, and I didn't realize that you had to have a visibly perfect body. That was not something that I had known before, so that was something I wanted to bring up on this podcast, because I think that's kind of an important thing, especially given we were talking about how people dealt with disabilities last week. So that that's something I hadn't realized before. I also didn't realize until I read your article that there are cases of intersex individuals, like you were saying, that they had to investigate to see if the person could be a priest.
Yeah, so it's hard to say how much this would have come up. I mean, it sort of relates to, and I hope you'll forgive me, I have to start with the principle of being male, and I have to talk about Pope Joan.
Yes.
I have to, because it's just too great. So there is this, in principle, certainly exclusion of women from the priesthood, but there is this myth of Pope Joan, which, if people don't know, it is a medieval myth. So it is not a modern myth about the Middle Ages. It is a medieval myth about the Middle Ages. And so in the 13th century, we first find this myth that in the 9th century, a woman disguised herself as a man so that she could follow her lover to Athens to get an education. And that she was so impressive that she became pope and then got pregnant and gave birth while on public procession through Rome, and that this led to the idea that there had to be a special coronation ritual for the Pope that involved checking the Pope to make sure that he had all of his man parts. And this is in the Borgias TV show, if anybody has seen that. It's not true that they did this inspection, I'm sorry to say. It would be so entertaining if they did, but there's no sign. There was this story told that they did not respond to it by checking popes before they were elected, as far as we know. In principle, they were supposed to check intersex individuals to make sure that they were sufficiently male-seeming. We don't know of that ever happening for ordination to priesthood. There's a couple of cases where it came up for marriage, that basically the union had to look sufficiently heterosexual. So it had to be a predominantly male with a female, or it had to be a predominantly female with a male. There was some room for flexibility with that, but it had to sort of function that way, as far as we know. I mean, this is not my work. This is my wonderful friend Christoph Rolker's work, but it's fascinating. They would check for castration. There are dispensations that you had to get in some cases, and so somebody had to somehow have figured out that a candidate for the priesthood was missing testicles. And then that person would then, in principle, have had to say, can I please be a priest anyway? And those dispensations were granted. But it is, it's more common that it would be something like, I'm missing one of my fingers, or I have, you know, a hunched back, or something like that. Those were more often concerns.
And could you get a dispensation to allow you to be a priest if you'd had a hunched back, for example? Could you get that dispensation?
Yeah. Yeah, there aren't a lot of them, though. This is one of the things. When there's only so many dispensations that we can find, it's hard to know whether that means that they were being told no, or whether they didn't ask, or whether they didn't need it. You know, there's these three possibilities. There's four, right? Either there's no dispensation because there was one, but it hasn't survived, or they asked for a dispensation, but were told no, because it really mattered to the higher ups that a hunchback not be a priest, or it was so normal for hunchbacks to be priests that nobody bothered to get a dispensation. And I said there was a fourth possibility, didn't there?
That's all right.
Get the idea.
Yeah.
The difficulty of these sources is it's so hard to know how to measure what really mattered. Whether the absence or presence of dispensation means something, it's tricky.
Yeah.
But we have to work with what we've got.
Exactly. And what we have got, if we get back to illegitimate priests for a moment, is a lot of dispensations for people who were illegitimate. So if we come back to this for a second, how common was it to get a dispensation if you were illegitimate to become a priest? Because it seems like there's a lot of those.
Yeah, it's extremely common. It's extremely common. So there are literally thousands of these. There are thousands and thousands of these, especially for the 15th century, but as early as the 13th century, you've already got quite a few. And sometimes they're in bulk. So it's 1,000 people getting a dispensation for their illegitimate birth to be able to stay priests or to advance to a higher level of the priesthood. And so it's everywhere. It's a huge percentage of people. And scholars haven't really known what to make of that. On the whole, they've assumed that this is evidence that illegitimacy was so horrible that it was necessary to deal with this horrible thing. What I'm trying to show is that it's more of a sign that illegitimacy was something that they were willing to overlook, and that these dispensations were a way of making it possible. There's a bunch of other reasons why you would want to require a dispensation on the one hand and then give it, because it puts you in a position of power to be able to say, well, I will only allow you to be bishop if you get a dispensation from me, and now you owe me a favor.
Yes. And also was an excellent fundraiser as well, wasn't it?
Yes, you could collect fees for these things. So there's it's a deeply complicated and kind of mysterious business, but there's an awful lot of priest sons and sons of all kinds of illicit unions who, especially in the 15th century, are asking for and getting dispensations. And this is, I mean, it's a problem of our sources. We only really know about the yeses. If there were noes, they haven't survived. And so in a way, it's kind of astonishing to me that a lot of the previous interpretations of these sources are so negative and see this as saying something about how bad illegitimacy was, when in fact what they're saying, what these sources we have are saying in largest quantity, loudest voice, is it's okay, you're a bastard, you can still be a priest.
Which I think is a huge deal, especially when we think of how people look back and think that, you know, that was it for you if you were born out of wedlock.
Right. And so that's basically what I was trying to demonstrate. And there's certainly a lot of other people who may not have even needed a dispensation and were, it's hard to say who was, if anybody was obviously illegitimate, but there are people who we can tell were the children of priests because it's, you know, clearly stated in the sources. And as far as we know, they never got dispensations. And so either, again, they got one and we don't know about it. But the other possibility is they didn't need it because it didn't matter. It seems to have mattered most when maybe somebody else wanted a position that you had. So it's a tool for the people who could grant the dispensations to get influence over the person they appoint, to get money from the person they appoint. But it's also a tool for people who want to remove somebody. So accusing someone of being illegitimate is a powerful sort of discursive weapon because they then might have to deal with the paperwork of either going to some kind of papal legate or going to Rome or somehow getting somebody to say, even though you are of illegitimate birth, it's okay, you can be a priest, you can be a bishop, you can be a cardinal, you can be an abbot. It's a very complicated thing, but I mean, on the whole, the evidence we have is of it not getting in people's way in the end. It might have been a hindrance, but it was not any kind of absolute barrier at all. Absolutely not. You know, it's being a woman that kept you from being a priest, not being illegitimate.
And as you're talking, I'm thinking about the conversation I had with Ruth Mazocaris a couple of weeks ago about how at this time it was really easy to be married because you had to say the right words and then consummate it, and that was it. So I'm thinking if you accuse someone of being illegitimate, it might be actually really hard to prove your legitimacy. So it's really quite the weapon to use against someone.
Right. No, exactly. It's extremely, I mean, in some cases, at least, it might have been really difficult to know whether or not you were actually legitimate or not. And in some cases, it's not right. So if your father is a bishop and your mother is a nun, and they're both actively bishops and nuns at the time that you were conceived and born, that's a pretty clear-cut case.
Yes.
Unless it could somehow be proven that your mother did not actually profess as a nun, or that she had professed but she was forced, and there are cases like this, or she didn't know she was a nun, right? So, or you might not know that your parents, you know, you might have been raised by your mother's sister, and there are cases like that, too, where people would be raised by someone else, might not know who their actual parents were, or they did, but nobody else knew. And so it gets enormously complicated, but certainly with your ordinary married folk, there's every possibility for some kind of complexity. You may think that your parents were legally married. They may think they were legally married, but they weren't. either because one of them had previously married somebody else, didn't know, or thought the first spouse was dead, but they weren't dead, or there's some kind of violation of an incest rule, like they didn't know that they were third cousins. And so that creates all kinds of possible complexity and, in principle, illegitimacy. And it's particularly the incestuous marriages, the so-called incestuous marriages, right? So these are not usually brother, sister, but more like second cousin, third cousin, fourth cousin, something like that. And in those cases, you might have known, or you might have applied for a dispensation, or you might not have, but it creates so much complexity that certainly it could have happened without people knowing, but also it could have happened with people knowing. And it did happen often with people knowing, particularly with nobility and royalty. And those people became priests all the time. I think I have a friend who told me that he found one case of a dispensation in that kind of situation, but he hasn't sent it to me yet. So it's... So for children of incest to be in the same category as children of priests sort of suggests just how unimportant it could have been for ordination, in that almost all of these important people had some kind of, well, illegal marriages were not rare, I'll just say.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned in the article as well that there's a certain expectation that people are going to sin. So there are dispensations where people are asking for forgiveness rather than permission for marriages, for ordination, and all sorts of things.
Yeah. I mean, this is something I'm playing with, and I'm hoping I can develop to the point where I can either convince people or be convinced that I'm wrong. And I'm really open to being convinced that I'm wrong, but I feel like there were so many ways in which you could sin in medieval Europe that there was a general sense that you were going to sin because you were human and humans are not great, and that everybody was going to mess up, but there were mechanisms to deal with it. So you should try to be better. You should try not to sin. But if you were going to sin, then there were, there are things you could do. There's penance you can do. There's fines you can pay. And then there's a possibility for rehabilitation and sort of moving on in a way that that we don't always recognize, because we see the viciousness of medieval society, which was absolutely there. And in a way, the fact that, or at least my suspicion, that alongside this viciousness were these really striking, sort of bizarre acts of mercy, the inconsistency almost makes it worse. Because it's, they were on the one hand really vicious, intolerant people, and on the other hand, shockingly merciful. Like the number of sins that they would forgive, when you have it lined up right next to all that viciousness, it doesn't, on the whole, make medieval society that great, because you never know which one you're going to get, whether you're going to get the viciousness or the mercy or both. But I think we have to recognize that the mercy was there. I mean, a lot of the canon law treatises will say, when you are thinking about punishing, and this gets back to what you raised about, visiting the sins of the parents on the children. So canon law treatises would say, if you are going to punish, always remember that mercy is more important than justice. And know that, you have responsibility as pastor of your flock. And so this would apply to kings, to judges, to bishops, to everybody, that they had a responsibility to somehow ensure the salvation of everyone in their responsibility. Everyone they had power over. And so they were supposed to show mercy sometimes. Sometimes they were supposed to, viciously execute or exile or banish or mutilate. But sometimes they were supposed to say, okay, you married illegally and you did it on purpose, but you're sorry now, so fine. Children are almost seen as an opportunity to correct the sins of the parents And I think one of the reasons, or at least it's possible that one of the reasons so many children of illegitimate relationships in medieval Europe ended up in some kind of religious position, monks, nuns, priests, is in part an effort to kind of expiate the sin. And it's seen as that in some of the letters, and they'll say, you know, you son of priest and nun are, you know, undoing the sins of your parents by your incredible, wonderful example of piety and scholarship or whatever. And so, you know, it is appropriate that you should be allowed to advance as far in religious life as possible. And so we give you this dispensation to facilitate that.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, it's always complicated when we're looking at a whole continent and we're looking at 1,000 years to try and find a lot of consistency when people were treating things kind of on a case-by-case basis. And I think you're right that it's important to remember the mercy and the flexibility that was there, because it was there, it did exist. And one of the things that I really liked about your article is talking about how fitting it is that the church is the place where they come up with the rules for who is legitimate and who's not. But then the church is also the place that welcomes those children into its arms, that the church is not just a place to, I think you say, to deposit a family's rejects, but it's a place that gives opportunities to people that might not have had that many outside of it.
Yeah, I think you say that much more nicely than I do.
No.
But it is a point that I really wanted to try to play with in this article, that you know, we see the Catholic Church as creating all of these impossibly strict rules for our tastes, our modern Western liberal tastes, I guess, is who I have, the group I have in mind when I say our, that, you know, that you have to marry indissolubly for life, that even if you can't have children with that person, you're still committed, and that if you say that you want to be a priest or a nun, that's it, you're committed for life, there's no getting out of it, and you can't deviate from all of that. There's all of these high expectations in the theory of the Catholic Church, but at the same time, it is welcoming of illegitimate children, and it's odd to say welcoming when there's all of these rules. You know, there's all kinds of religious institutions that would say in their statutes and principle, no illegitimate children here, but then you see the hundreds of exceptions that are being made. And when the exception becomes the rule, it's hard to see it as a real rule, or it's hard to see it as meaning what we would think of it as meaning. And it is nice. And it would be really cool to be able to try to do some kind of comparison to other societies where children they counted as illegitimate ended up. I think I sort of knew anecdotally of other societies where they ended up in the military. It's possible that there's a lot of illegitimate children in the military in Europe as well, and we just don't know much about it. There's basically one book I found that talked about the illegitimate children, mostly of nobles in France in the Hundred Years' War, but it's not something that's been explored that deeply. It's the field of illegitimacy, of studying illegitimate children, is kind of growing right now. There's a whole bunch of new and exciting scholarship, especially coming out of France, but there's not as much earlier work. So it's surprising how little we knew about something that, you know, we think of as such a central feature of the medieval family, right? The exclusion of the bastard is supposed to be such an essential feature. And yet we really don't have as much writing on it as you would think. And there's so much more to do with it, I think.
Well, thanks to you, we know a lot more than we did before. So thank you.
Well, that's nice to think.
Yes. Well, I've definitely learned a lot from your article on Bastard Priests, and I hope people will go and read it. Thanks for talking to us about it. It's really interesting. And like you say, I think there's a lot more to be learned about it, because it was an important feature, maybe not as important as we tend to think, but an important feature of society. So thanks for opening our eyes about this.
Oh yeah, my pleasure. No, I mean, it's definitely important, just not what we thought, not the Scarlet Bee.
That's right. And not something out of Game of Thrones, perhaps.
Alas, no. Although Game of Thrones is awfully fun.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure too.
Sarah's article, Bastard Priests, Illegitimacy and Ordination in Medieval Europe, can be found in the January 2019 issue of Speculum. And you can find links to her other work, including work on illegitimacy, priests, and everyone's favorite bastard, Jon Snow, on her faculty website, www.jjay.cun.edu/faculty/Sarah-McDougall. Or you can follow the link in our show notes on medievalist.net. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net telling us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, we're doing well. We just got posted this news piece about a returning course, online course, on the Book of Kells. It's run by Trinity College Dublin. They hosted it last year. It's this kind of free online MOOC. Massive open online content course, something like that. That's what it means. But it's all about that Irish manuscript from the 9th century, this one of the most famous medieval manuscripts in the world. It was really popular last year, so they're bringing it back just in time for St. Patrick's Day. And you can get all the information about this course on our website that just came on this site today. And if you're also looking for some fun reading, we have a piece on killer kittens in Arthurian legend. So lots of fun there.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks.
As I mentioned last week, medievalists.net and I are setting up a Patreon page with lots of great rewards in order to help us make the podcast even better, from transcription services to better sound editing. If you're interested in becoming a patron, stay tuned. We should have it up and running soon. In the meantime, leaving us a review on your favorite platform will really go a long way. For more great medieval content, you can follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And you can follow me, Danielle Sobalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. For some quick and interesting 5-minute information, as well as tips on how to use medieval wisdom to survive the zombie apocalypse, you can always find my books on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks so much for listening, and always for your support. Have an awesome day.